Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello, welcome along to this week's episode of the Let's Get Running podcast. It's our weekly show now. We're starting on a Monday. This should be in your eardrums, and you'll hear the voice of the Caramel Kid in your eardrums. How are you doing?
And annoyingly, you're going to hear the White Devil.
Yeah, sorry, yeah? That's the trade-off, everybody. You have to have my ears as well. How are you doing after the England victory? Did you watch it?
I did. I was struggling, complaining.
Yeah.
We were getting cheated.
Yeah.
They were getting away with loads of stuff.
Then the
referee was Colombian.
Yeah.
We could get Colombia in the next, in the last 16. So I'm thinking little backhand deals are going on, you know, corruption.
Yeah.
It is Russia after all. They're probably blood doping.
Yeah. It's all kicking off. Yeah. It was good though. It was good to see him get a little goal at the end there. I've got a mate who lives in New Zealand. He's got two kids. Totally out of the blue. His kid watches the England football team because it's New Zealand is rubbish, let's face it. And he walked up to his dad the other day and said, Dad, my favourite is the Hurricane and Dilly Dally. And then just walked off again.
Harry Kane. Yeah. Oh, he said the Hurricane.
He did. He calls him the Hurricane. Yeah, the Hurricane and Dilly Dally. Yeah, it was brilliant.
He's not fast.
So that was good. And we're probably going to miss the recording of the England-Panama game, but this isn't a football podcast, it's a running podcast. How's work been? Have you had any bus mishaps?
I was on a 171,
yeah.
And there was a really big accident on Woolworth Road.
Yeah.
So they said, oh, you need to take the side streets to get to Camberwell. So I'm going driving down it, obviously people on the bus sleeping early in the morning.
Yeah.
Get halfway down, there's more signposts saying, oh, different diversion. So when I got halfway down, I'm like, oh, do I go the diversion way or keep going the line of route way?
Yeah.
Thinking, oh, I'm just going to keep going that route. And then literally 20 meters before the main road, the road was closed.
Oh.
And I was like, oh, crap. So I had to reverse the bus. People were moaning. People thought I was trying to kidnap them. And then I had to go back to it. 20 minutes the other way, yeah. And go on a diversion, which I didn't know.
No.
But people weren't happy.
You should have really played up to it, said, everybody get down! be quiet! We're going on a new one!
My usual trick, I usually go, sorry, new driver. That's my usual trick. I've only been here a couple of days, sorry, new driver.
Hey. We've got an interesting podcast for our listeners today. We talked to a guy called Sam. Sam Robinson lives over in America, in the US. He lives down in Oakland. And we're talking a bit about the difference in running culture between America and here in the UK. So our kind of chat before that, Jermaine, we were thinking of talking about how our running has been influenced in different ways by culture or by things that are going on in society or whatever. So like, it's a weak link, but maybe how Strava's changed the way we think about our running and how social media has affects us. And what do you think? How did you start off, Jermaine? And why did you choose running as a sport? And what influenced you to stick at it?
Obviously, stuck at it 'cause I like the success.
Yeah.
But started off just as a social.
Yeah. So was there a culture of it in your school? Was everyone doing it, or was it quite a niche thing?
No. Like, so, I just literally turned up to muck around with friends. We were never interested in running.
Yeah.
Like, we used to go and play football after, so we didn't even give it 100%. We used to turn up, run with the coach, do the bare minimum, and then go on.
Yeah.
So it was just social.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was different then because we did, you know, like, social media wasn't big there. You know, like, it was non-existent. Like, there was no mobile, you know, things like that.
You just did it for yourself.
Well, in the end, yeah, but I think we just went because to socialise. Yeah, social media changes so much stuff now. So for how we used to started running, it's probably way different to like youngsters starting running now.
Yeah, and like with Strava, like do you use Strava?
I did when I cycled, but I think people cheat.
Right.
Because obviously people are competitive.
Yeah.
And on a push bike, you go down one road and you see some of the speeds that people cycle down these roads. And you think they must have been on a moped.
Yeah.
You can't trust other people. Are you mad? No.
And it never affects. If you're out on a run, right, you wouldn't think, oh, right, there's a segment here. I'm going to try and smash it so I can lead the segment. You never think that when you're running, would you?
Well, I never use Strava for running.
No.
Like okay. When I run, I always run natural, au natural.
Au natural.
But when I cycle, yeah, I look for segments and push. So it did affect me when I was trying to, you know, like do the cycling and stuff. I was thinking, okay, yeah, this road. But then it's dangerous because you're trying to sprint down this road when you're cycling.
Yeah.
Going through red lights and stuff.
Yeah. And do you think like, well, I don't know about you because you're a smooth, like you've always just been like a smooth runner, right?
But smooth Carol, yeah.
Smooth
Carol,
yeah.
I know you're married, but come on now. Don't let me tell the wife.
But for me, I was like, I'm influenced by like the way I want to train. My idols in running are people like Steve Jones, people who go out and like, they're all about pushing hard and showing how strong and hard working they are. And people now like Callum Hawkins, he's like another tough man who we all love in British athletics. I wonder like if that affects the way, I think it probably does affect the way that I approach training and racing. I want to be like these guys. Do you think that's ever, you ever thought I want to be like a certain runner or I want to train like a certain person?
Well, I wanted to be like Michael Johnson, but I couldn't sprint, so I just bought the gold chain instead.
You are the long distance version of Michael Johnson. But that makes sense, though, doesn't it? Like, that makes sense. You want to be smooth and look good while you're running, so that's the way you've trained and raced and improved yourself. Like, so we are kind of all affected.
So for a little country bumpkin like yourself,
yeah.
You wanted to be the tough man of the village.
Tough man of the village.
So you can bowl back into town.
Yeah, yeah.
Like the sheriff.
Yeah, if anyone wants to wrong on me, they've got to be able to bang. And bang hard. That's how I do it.
So what would say, like, made you get into running and stick with running and stuff?
Oh, I think running's affected me, like, tremendously. It's made me the person I am. And that is a person who doesn't give up, who works hard, and who just wants to succeed. And I think that is, running kind of has become like, I don't know, not become me, but like, I want, the same thing as I want in my running, I think the same thing as I want to do in my life. So I think it fits in with, I've become, you know, it's become just part of my life and part of who I want to be. Do you know what I mean? We should get on with listen to the interview. It's interesting to think about how, yeah, we're affected by the, where are we are and what the, you know, the trends are of our age and that sort of thing, how it affects our running. So yeah, we'll talk to Sam about that now. Here he is. On today's show, we are speaking to Sam Robinson. Sam's over in the US. How you doing, Sam?
Hey, Sean, I'm well. Thank you so much for having me on. It's a pleasure. It's a real pleasure.
Good to talk to you. We met in London a few years ago, where we both ran for Highgate Harriers. Whereabouts are you now? Where do you live?
So now I live in Oakland, California, which is just across from the San Francisco Bay, across from San Francisco. So it's foggy days here now, here in the summer. We've got a nice marine layer that's settled in, and I'm looking out the window at gray skies, and it's in the 60s, and while the rest of America is just sweltering in incredible heat, it's it's a bit cool outside. So,
wow.
So we met, what was this, 2013?
Yeah.
The Highgate Harriers?
Yeah.
I remember when we met. I actually have a distinct memory of, I was out doing dissertation research for my history doctorate in London. Yeah. And I was just sort of lonely, running by myself, and was sort of searching on the internet for a club, and I found Highgate Harriers. And so I was living in this like incredibly cramped apartment in near Golders Hill, and just like jogged down from the tube stop there and found you guys. And you were doing, I think, mile repeats around.
Oh, yeah.
Around like a field starting from the track.
Yeah.
And I remember it because I thought I was in just amazing shape. And so I came there like this cocky American, like, oh, these Brits, these like South England boys, they're like, what, how good can they possibly be? And and then you promptly, I think I tried to like tuck in behind, you know, you guys up towards the front, and we ran the fastest mile that I run in like 12 months. And, by the third, I remember thinking like, I have made a terrible mistake. This is not going the way I expected it, and was just utterly, utterly broken by the workout. I was just like, you know, but at the end, leaning over, wheezing, hands on my knees. I was bent over so far, I think my head was up my own ass. And
baptism of fire.
Yeah, just like nearly like just utterly done. And somebody came up and like patted me on the back. Like, you all right, mate? You look a bit shattered. And that's the first time I'd heard that expression. And I thought, how apt. I do indeed feel shattered emotionally and physically. So that was my introduction to the Highgate Harriers. And so very great.
We wouldn't have it any other way. And obviously you're running over there in the US. Do you remember That's Fine Track Club?
Yes, indeed. Yeah. We're based in the East Bay here in Oakland and Berkeley. It's where most of us are, although we've got satellite members all over the country. We are now organized around the USATF, but we're mostly it's almost sort of a, how do I describe it, kind of an informal hipster running club of mostly post-collegiate runners, but then we've got a lot of folks who are actually coming from different perspectives and different trajectories. Either they didn't run in college or have picked it up afterwards, which is a little bit different for a competitive running club. The great news in our household is my wife, who also runs for the club, hit her Olympic trials qualifier last weekend for the marathon.
Nice.
So we are utterly, what is it? What do you say? That we are utterly chuffed? Is that the right
word? Yeah, I was going to say stoked, but that's probably a bit more Australian, isn't it? Stoked, but chuffed sounds very English. Yeah,
stoked as well. Everyone says stoked out here now. It's really rad. It's like a really gnarly day. Yeah, so she hit the... She hit the standard, and we're really happy. So she'll be going to her third Olympic marathon trials in 2020.
And I'm really interested in the difference in culture, sort of running culture between the US and the UK. Did you see a big difference between running sort of Highgate and running back where you are now?
I was so incredibly struck with the running scene in the UK. And I think it's because the club system is just different, and the way they work, it's structured differently. In the U.S., sport, just to a great extent, is structured and linked to the American educational system.
Yeah.
So, if you're going to get into competitive running, like cross country or track and field, it's going to be in high school, and if you're fortunate and talented and lucky enough by competing in college, every high school has their own cross country and track team. It's the way, you know, soccer and American football and basketball. It's structured by the educational system. Every school has a team linked to it.
Yeah.
And so what that means is that sport, as we understand it, track and field and cross country is largely understood as kind of something that, you know, young kids do. And if you want to get into the club scene here, it's sort of a post-collegiate club scene. And unfortunately, college athletics is incredibly hard and elitist to get into. There's not enough funding to give people an opportunity to compete for a college team. It's really hard to get onto a division two or three or one squad, like a D1 squad is really elite. So there's a bit of a disconnect from the competitive scene and the more running enthusiast and community scene in a way that I think is problematic for the American running community.
Yeah.
One of the things I was really struck by is that because the scene in the UK seems so much more, the clubs seem more community and neighborhood oriented, you have this wide spectrum of runners and age and place and interest level all in the same club.
Yeah.
And you don't usually see that in the United States. You have like maybe, you know, you'll have some like local enthusiast runners who are, say, like maybe in like a beer running club in the States, and then you'll have at the same time you'll have like the Bowerman Track Club, which is at the opposite end of the spectrum, which is guys, you know, and girls who are trying to go to the Olympics. And so, and then all the way in between, but they tend to be kind of isolated unto themselves and they don't kind of overlap that often. Whereas in the UK it looks as if It's as if you could be in a club and you can see, you can, if you were, say, like, maybe you're a 12-year-old runner, you can look up and you can see someone like Sean Dixon, you know, like running fast 10Ks, and you can see an immediate example of where you might could go with the sport. I don't know, what you grew up with in the UK, was the club system like that?
Yeah, I think so. I came from a small town where there wasn't really a big club there, but there was a guy who sort of set something up, and there wasn't an adults division, but it was still everybody that ran was going through the same competitions throughout the year. So you'd do your school's cross country, you'd do the national cross country, and it seems it's quite, if you're interested in running, you know about these events and you did them. I think that's quite good about the UK, that you do all levels of abilities have the opportunity to be involved in that world of elite running. Do you know what I mean? I don't know if it's the same in the US, where once you've gone through the college system, is it easy then to kind of compete and find and be part of the cycle of track and cross country and that sort of thing?
It is if you've gone through the college system, because you know where to look.
Okay.
And you know that it's an option. Yeah, you know, I also grew up in a small town, but the only people who did cross country and track and field were high school age athletes.
Right.
They're just not sports that people can do in places like rural North Carolina. There just aren't opportunities for that. Now, there are, one could search out like a road 5K, but what we sort of see as like competitive athletics, the things that are sort of Olympic level sports, there's just no opportunity for that. When I growing up, I don't remember there being any sort of situation where you could join a club.
Yeah.
Outside of school, they're just school teams to compete on.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's different in that sense. And I think if you're lucky and fortunate enough to compete in college, you know, the world is your oyster. But if you come into the sport a little bit later in life, there's a bit of a learning curve you need to figure out. And unfortunately, there can be some barriers.
Yeah.
Barriers of entry. Yeah. It can be intimidating for someone who's coming into the sport later in life to try to jump into a track 10K, because there's no example of how someone might do that.
And do you think it reflects on the wider interest in the sport? Do you think are people interested in watching athletics in the US, or is it a very niche sport that only the very elite are really interested in?
I'm afraid it's more the latter. That's my sense, and it's because the experience is foreign to most Americans because they just can't see it. I think people would be very interested in it if they knew that it was something that they could engage in. But, you know, I mean, obviously, like, the internet has changed things because it's created an avenue for more niche cultures to be able to publish and put content, stories, and narratives out there. But yeah, I mean, you can go to, say, like Beta Breakers, which is the famous, you know, 12K here in San Francisco, and the majority of people who are running the race have no idea or interest who is going to win the race, or that it even is a race. Right?
Yeah.
They're just out there to run and have a good time. And Beta Break is kind of a weird one because people, half of everybody there is running naked or in costume. Yeah. But in true San Francisco style, you know, if you're not somewhat intoxicated or naked by the time you're halfway through the race, then you've done something wrong.
Yeah.
But there are other races where it's sort of the same, because our system is so entrenched where, you know, competitive running sports, cross country, track, are so ingrained in the educational system and so dictated and structured by the NCAA, which is itself, you know, a pretty anti-democratic institution. It'll be a hard barrier to cross, and so it's a natural disadvantage to trying to bridge that divide between your mid-pack runner who comes into the sport because, you know, they're in their 30s and they want to do something that's more active. They're looking for a community to join, and the person who's towards the front.
Yeah.
So yeah, there are some structural barriers that I think come up in the way.
Do you think
that may not be there in the UK?
Yeah. And do you think, obviously, American distance running, and particularly in the marathon and female distance runners, is going through a bit of a resurgence? Has that had any effect, do you think, on the ground amongst runners in the US?
I hope so. And in particular, in regards to the women runners, I mean, I really, really do hope that the increase in representation of women and people of color in, you know, towards the front of these fields is, you know, I would imagine that that can be a source of inspiration if these stories can get translated into mainstream media.
Yeah.
It definitely seems like it. I mean, my community, though, like, is the running community, right? So when so when someone like Desi Linden wins Boston, like, we're all freaking out. But, you know, that's my bubble.
Yeah.
And, you know, the extent to which people know who Shalane Flanagan is, beyond that, I would still think, you know, it's probably pretty limited. But it is something to be said. I mean, I'll say I'll notice that in American media outlets, in, like, Runner's World and Outside Magazine, there's been a really strong push to inject more diversity in the representation of some of the content they're putting out there and some of the stories that they're making. And I think that's only a good thing. Yeah. The more people that are involved and the more people who are represented, the more types of interest that you're going to draw in, and the more the merrier, man.
Yeah, exactly.
I hope so. It does seem like there is a resurgence. I wonder, it's interesting that it seems like this is the best of times and the worst of times for American distance running, but it's been that way for a long time.
Yeah. And do you, when you did London, I don't know if you noticed a difference between if just running of a lunchtime or around the city during the day, did you notice more people just doing it actively than you see, say, in San Francisco, or is it similar levels of participation?
It really depends on where you are in the country. I mean, comparing between a place like London and a place like San Francisco, it's probably similar, in terms of the levels of engagement, levels of participation. I will say, as an aside, I saw a lot of people run commuting in London, which I don't see here in the States. Right. I was really impressed by that. Like, people who looked like they were actually trying to go somewhere to get something done.
Right.
On the run.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember thinking, like, man, these people are awesome. Wow. This is great. I can't believe they're carrying a laptop for 5 miles. I could never do that. So that's an experience that was pretty different for me.
Yeah.
But you do see, you know, there's a big running community here. And so even if they're not quite synced in to the competitive mindset in the way that you guys have in the UK, or even if there are some of these hurdles that are put up by the way we set up things, by the way we set up like sports like cross country and track and athletics, track and field, there's still a huge running community, especially in places like this. But America is a big country, and so there are large sections of it that there really isn't anything. Parts of the Southeast, parts of the Midwest, you know, it's a very unequal nation, and so it tends to be the big coastal cities where there are, you know, more opportunities for distance running, and there are more places where you can find people of like interest. And San Francisco, places like San Francisco and Portland and Seattle and the Colorado Front Range and even New York now, there are just tons of running clubs and like casual running clubs or people who are training for marathons and trying to do their best, you know, improve and you know, even if they're not running, you know, 63.5 marathons, there's still some pretty stout runners that are involved in that.
Yeah.
So you see that, but then there are big gaps in different places too, where, you know, there might be a sporting culture, but it's oriented around American football and basketball and sports like that.
Yeah. I read your article about Trumpland and sort of being shouted at, called faggot with running shorts on and being thrown bottles at and stuff. And it sounds pretty horrific, really, in certain bits of the country.
Yeah, it was. There were a lot of instances of violence when I was growing up in the Southeast. And I mean, yeah, I wrote that, in December after the American election. And it was a cathartic piece in a lot of ways. And I've looked back on it and my ideas have evolved a little bit since writing it. But yeah, I mean, I think, oh man, you should read the comments in that piece. I touched a nerve there on both ends.
No.
On both ends, because there's some candid language in the piece. And so, but yeah, those experiences happened. I mean, running in the Southeast, I've had, I once got hit with a full Solo cup filled with beer. I've had things thrown at me. I got hit by a car twice, once on my bike, once running. I've had cars swerve off of the road trying to hit me. Thinking about it, I wonder if a lot of it was because I was in high school and college at the time, and young men tend to be not the most rational of people on both sides, and so being you know, a young high school runner. Where was I running? I was running around high schools with a lot of insane young other high school boys driving cars around high school.
Yeah.
College, I was running around, you know, a college town with a lot of insane young boys in cars around college town. So some of it might be a life cycle thing in terms of youth. But I think, you know, a lot of people picked up on you know, some of the violence that you know, I noticed. But they missed on some of the bits where I was talking about how this is an expression of resentment that comes from real economic distress that have hit parts of the United States. When I moved to my hometown, the local textile mill shut down because Walmart decided to buy all of their towels from South Asia, and it was the largest single day layoff in the history of North Carolina. When I was in college, the local cigarette plant shut down, and so in the 90s, this got masked over a fair amount by the strength of the economy. But one of the points of the piece was that moving through it on foot and running through it, a lot of the economic distress that got glossed over by the strength of the bubbles, housing bubble and things like that, it was still evident if you were running through it on foot.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't, you know, I wasn't running through like abject poverty, but you just saw the sense of resentment that manifested itself in the last couple of years. And so that was the big point of the piece, was that it was, you know, what we're living through was being telegraphed. We just weren't paying attention. And if you'd been running through it, maybe we would have noticed it sooner.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that being said, I really think everyone should visit the Piedmont in North Carolina, where I grew up. It's some beautiful country, rolling hills. You know, you've got beaches on the western side and mountains on the eastern side.
Yeah.
And things have gotten better. I mean, things were really bad during the recession, where there was a lot of unemployment and a lot of stagnation, but things have bounced back, and the people are strong and hearty, and the vast majority of folks who live in my hometown would never throw beer at somebody running down the road. So I go home and I run, you know, without anxiety. I still have a few altercations every now and then, but it seems to have gotten better, and I'm not quite sure if that's because I've gotten older and know where to avoid, or just a lot of that.
It could
be a cultural thing as well.
Yeah.
You know, I think, you know, if you're running in short shorts in parts of the Southeast, there was, you know, a lot of latent homophobia which could come out, and you know, the culture's changed in a lot of ways, even in more conservative parts of the country. We've become a bit more libertarian and liberal in that regard.
Yeah, I read another article you wrote about sort of Strava. And you sit on Strava? Are you still using it? Are you still a Strava fan?
Yeah. I've become more and more of a Strava fan.
Yeah,
I did write a piece in Strava. Yeah, for Outside Magazine.
Have you seen the Strava Strava Wankers Twitter thing?
Yes, I follow them. It's been a little while since I've seen a tweet. I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, there's just so much outrage on Twitter lately that you know, the little bit of Strava outrage maybe gets buried in it. But it's pretty funny.
But it's great. Has it changed your experience changed your experience of running over the last sort of 5 or 6 years?
Undoubtedly. And I don't think it's like, has it changed it for the better, changed it for the worse? I think it's just changed it.
Yeah.
And a lot of that is because it's a platform that is about social connection. And so you're able to meet and communicate with fellow runners and that maybe aren't physically proximate to you or who you might not have otherwise seen. So there's sort of a Facebook element to it. And actually, this is probably my favorite parts of it. You know, you can, I curate a club on there where I can just send out events that are coming up. You know, if I'm leading a weekly run from a local trail, I can shoot it out and 2,700 people get a notification saying, would you like to come out to this trail run and join Sam for the trail? And that's pretty darn cool that you can create a community of runners that crosses regional and national boundaries like that. But it does change the day-to-day experience of running as well when you start thinking about how your performance is being overlaid onto the performances of others, where there are these comparisons between the way that you ran down a given section of street and then you uploaded, and all of a sudden you're being placed next to other folks, and there's this imminent comparison between different runners. And what that does is it because there are these segments that are out there now, the landscape that we run through, the streets, the hills, the trails, they're just laden over with new forms of meaning. They're just pregnant with value that they didn't have. I'll give you an example. So, like, last Sunday, I was running with a group of guys. We were going to do, we were just doing a 16-mile loop. And for most of it, we were just running, you know, like a casual pace that you would hold for 16 miles, conversational, right?
Yeah.
Just a whole bunch of lads out there getting along running.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, if you were viewing it objectively, you would sort of see, for no reason, one of these runners just takes off and starts running 5-minute pace as hard as he can, and just throws down like a 5-minute mile just randomly in the middle of this long run.
Yeah.
Well, there was a segment he was going for, and so he was like trying to get on the leaderboard of this segment, and, you know, cool for him, but like that is weird and strange and peculiar that he is suddenly now trying, like, this, nothing changed. Like there was nothing different about the landscape looking around it, except now that it's been interfaced with this digital level of community and communal interaction and comparison and competition.
And
it definitely changed. I mean, how can it not change the way you run? Everybody, like,
it definitely
when
does.
I wrote that again, have you noticed a theme, Sean? When I write things, they tend to be a little bit provocative.
Yeah.
So the Strava piece had like the title, like Strava's Murdering the Loneliness of Distance Running or something like that.
Yeah.
I didn't give it that title. The editors did. But you know, if you're gonna write something, it's gonna be on social media. You gotta kind of break through the noise somehow.
So, yeah. Yeah.
So, but I mean, so people were like, no, there's no way that's the case. Like, yeah, look around. Everybody's running differently.
Yeah.
We're all understanding our relationship to distance running in a different way. And again, I don't think that it's good or bad. I like the app, but I just like to think critically about the way that we use it. And I'm very fascinated by the way in which these new digital platforms are changing our physical relationship to the sport, and in that sense I think it's pretty interesting.
We had a good talk with a sports psychologist on the last show, and he was talking about how useful Strava is in retrospectively looking back and analyzing particular performance in races and using that as a trick to change your to train your mind, and that you can see certain sections where perhaps you might remember it, the data might bring back memories where you maybe didn't push as hard as you could, or you lost concentration, but the data helps bring back those memories, and therefore they can then think, right, I knew at this stage I didn't quite push as hard as I should do. In my next race, that is going to be my focus. And he said it's really useful. The data becomes really, really useful to you to think of moments and to bring moments back into your head where you could change the way you perform. So yes, it does have its uses.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. Yeah, I mean, you do get so much more data that you can break down in a way that you can't do just with a watch and maybe you're just your real memory, right?
Yeah.
You're like, you know, physical brain memory. And I'm not an exercise physiology guy or anything, or a coach for that matter, really. So I don't know what to do with it, but
it's there if you did need it. Yeah.
Yeah. even though I'm on there and all that data is on Strava, I'm old fashioned. I started a pen and paper running log in 2002, and I'm on volume 8 now.
Wow.
The composition note. I'm not going to stop. I'm just going to make sure that it's all in hard copy.
Yeah. It's something to show your kids. They won't have an interest in it, but it's something to show your kids in times of boredom.
Writers are supposed to... I think I read somewhere that writers should keep journals, and I don't keep a journal, so this will just have to work for that. And so, I'll donate it to an archive or something if anybody ever wants it.
The guy's very interesting point, sort of linking to another article that you've written.
Yeah.
He was talking a bit about how the majority of us, when we go and we train, we do interval sessions, we look to try and work hard and get the most from our body. But maybe when we then come to a race and we're so used to just push and looking for, trying to find the, I can't remember the name of the phrase you use in the article, the pain,
cave.
That's cave. Not, so looking for this pain cave. When you come to a race, when actually you're rested and you're ready and you want to be smooth, relaxed and confident, you then don't know how to do that. And it was an interesting article when you're talking about almost like the fetishization of pain, and how in the US maybe we love this, we look back on The Jewel in the Sun and we put people like Salazar as great characters, and for us Steve Jones in the UK, It's strange, yeah. Isn't it? How we just love, well, certainly in the UK, we love a gallant trier. We don't necessarily like a winner. We like someone that works really hard, and that for runners is the people we adore.
Isn't that curious? How that seems to be something that's embedded in our culture. This, I like the idea. I like that phrase, the fetishization of pain, because it does seem true. And I wonder if, to, you know, in the short history of this, it's why it's particularly acute in the Anglophone experience in the UK and the US. This sort of no pain, no gain. We love watching the person try up against, you know, unbreakable odds, and even if they don't win, at least they suffered a lot, right? Yeah. To do it. And so maybe there's a linking of this to like the Protestant work ethic. We've got some Puritan austerity that's so deep and structured into our cultural experience that we understand things. But yeah, it's interesting. There's so much pain talk in our discourse at the moment. There's been this explosion of performance literature that's largely about figuring out how to have a more effective relationship to pain, which is curious. I mean, you've got columnists like Brad Stolberg and Outside Magazine. Alex Hutchinson just wrote a book about endurance.
Yeah.
I actually, just last month, there was a piece in The Atlantic by Paul Visteglio, and it was reviewing books by endurance athletes like Scott Jurek's book that he just wrote, North, about running the length of the Appalachian Trail, trying to set a fastest known time there. And it was also reviewing another book by, I think, another runner, Jennifer Davis, I think, who ran it. In any event, and then Hutchinson's new book on the relationship between mind, body, and endurance, and it's sort of trying to dig deep about, you know, why is this literature coming out? And the point that he seemed to get into is that the best runners, they just don't ask. They don't ask why they're going into the pain cave, because if you try to explore it too much, you inevitably realize that this is an utterly futile, weird thing that you're trying to do, and you'll just give up. And so if you find yourself in like 8K into a 10K and you're just like utterly gone, you know, that bit where you've got like five laps left and it's just like, you know, you gotta dig deep. If you start interrogating why exactly you find yourself about, you know, 5 miles into a 10K race, suddenly, you know, starving of oxygen, you probably will not run that well. You'll think like, well, why am I running this? Who am I? That's not what like winners do. Winners just go for it. Which seems to be the point of the article. I think it's interesting. I mean, there is a real deep history to the pain cave, and one that goes beyond the English Reformation and Protestantism. If you look back over the history of mankind, you will see instances in which human beings self-inflict discomfort onto themselves and then take that discomfort and laden it with cultural meaning. Yeah. You have senses of self-flagellation in the medieval period. You have pilgrimages where people basically brought their bodies hundreds, if not thousands, of miles through incredible trial and tribulation just to visit some, you know, relic, some dead bone somewhere. I mean, like Canterbury Tales is basically about a whole bunch of people going on an uncomfortable hike. It is like the idea of the pain kit. It's something that is almost anthropological. I don't know. I mean, so, you know, I think that from a performance perspective, obviously the like trial and tribulation of pain, it doesn't seem like that's the best relationship. I think the last year or so, and it sounds like the folk person you were chatting with, they were getting into this as well, is if you want to have a more positive relationship to discomfort, to where you want to sort of have a more, I don't know, friends with it. You don't like the notion of sort of gritting through physical discomfort. One is, you know, it's pretty dangerous, especially in these ultra marathons. So maybe it's not the best mindset to take. It's this sort of like glorifying of the deep violence that we inflict upon our own bodies, but rather it might be about, you know, there might be a better framework in which we can understand things for performance.
And he was talking a lot about how sort of recognizing it's there, recognizing you are in the cave, but then thinking, how am I going to manage and deal with this relationship between my body not wanting to do it and my head wanting to still compete and finish and to kind of to relax through that phase. So it's relaxing in the pain cave that we should be doing now, rather than embracing it and trying to get
flexing work. Into it. Yeah. I mean, either way, like whichever position you take, it's pretty damn weird. Yeah. like if you were a rational person, you would just say, just stop. don't go in the pain cave anymore. And so there's always this we still do it. What's crazy about runners is you ask runners like, oh, you must really like being in pain, and most runners say, no, it's awful, terrible.
Yeah.
It's not a masochistic sport.
Yeah.
And yet we keep doing it. I'm not sure. I mean, maybe there's a way in which we've been conditioned to try to find meaning in sort of impossible pain, where, I don't know, constantly fighting for a personal best in distance running. You can maybe understand this materially, right? Like it fits into a sort of productive cycle, right? I mean, think about like capitalism, where there's this ethos where no performance is satisfactory and everything needs to be subsumed toward this relentless pursuit of self-improvement and productivity.
Yeah.
And so there might be this more insidious way. Like capitalism has even penetrated into our everyday lives, and even our free time as runners is just practice, where just life is all about turning out content and lines of code and track intervals.
Yeah.
And running is just something else that's thrown into that. Now, I don't know. I don't see myself as thinking too much about productivity when I'm running, but I would think that there's probably some relationship to our work lives that bleeds into our leisure lives as well. We certainly like to take our running lives as containing some sort of metaphorical meaning for the rest of our lives.
Yeah, certainly.
But I don't know.
Well, the first of my three final questions, which I ask to everybody, is, if you could be anywhere running right now, where would it be? It could be a race, or it could be just a special training place.
Well, I'll say, being out here in Northern California, up here, I live in the Oakland Hills, and about 2 miles from here, there is a grove of redwood trees that sits in a canyon in a regional park called Redwood Park. And I think for a lot of people, and myself included, that is a great place to just get away when you are incredibly stressed. I find just running through that redwood grove, it's very hilly, and so it's something I don't do every day, or every week even. But if I need to get out and kind of clear the head, I have this loop I do. It's actually not even that long, but a 2 mile loop, which involves a mile climb with about 700 feet of gain. And if I really need to clear my head, like huffing up that thing and back down it and back up it again a couple of times, that will work. That will do the trick. And if I need to decompress a little bit, I'll go to that and climb that hill. And just, it's almost meditative.
Yeah.
So I'll say that. I'll say this Redwood Grove and Redwood Park nearby.
And second question is, can you recommend something? So it could be a book, film, magazine, podcast, anything you'd recommend to our listeners.
I'm a voracious consumer of media. I read a lot of magazine articles and books, and I'm not choosy. Like, I like video games and YouTube videos and podcasts and all of that too. So I I've been weirdly reading a lot about death and dying this year, and I'm not even in a morbid mood. I just seem to have fallen into it. So The Death of Stalin is maybe the funniest movie I've seen in 2 or 3 years.
Right.
It's really good. I mean, it has Steve Buscemi, Jeffrey Tambor, and the great Michael Palin from Monty Python is in it.
I think it was in our local cinema last week. I think it might still be on, so I should get myself down for that.
Oh, you've got to go see it. It is really, it's sort of a slow burn. It's a lot of dark humor. But in these times, it is great to see that usually behind the brutal and vicious use of authority and power, there's often just a lot of idiocy laying behind it, because the people in control don't know what else to do other than punch someone in the face. So it's really, and it's somehow it takes a very morbid subject and makes it really funny.
And our third and final question is what, in your opinion, is the most inspirational running performance in history? Is it going to be something you've seen yourself?
I have no idea. I don't know. I don't know. So in history, gosh, yeah. You ask the guy with a history PhD and he has no answer. Yeah. I will say, I think inspiration can take a number of different forms. So I will just speak personally.
Yeah.
That for me, the most inspired, the performance that maybe had the biggest impact on my life was watching Alan Webb, the American middle distance runner, break the high school mile back in 2001. Jim Ryan's American high school record.
Yeah.
I watched that in my kitchen, standing next to my mother on our little small kitchen TV that was maybe like 8 inches wide.
Yeah.
And just screaming at the top of our lungs, jumping up and down on our feet as we watched this kid who was, you know, a couple years older than me.
Yeah.
Run faster than I'd ever seen somebody around my age run. And it was so inspiring and so impacting. And it was one of those moments where I remember watching that going like, I want to be like that. I want to try to be as fast as I can. It was such a cool moment.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we were talking earlier about the resurgence of distance running, and, you know, Webb was at the end of that generation that started in the 90s and went into the early aughts, that people like Emma Coburn and people like Des Linden and people who are a little bit younger than them now, who are moving up through the ranks, these were our heroes, right? These were the people that we were looking at, as folks like Dina Castor and Magda Boulay and Webb and Dathan Ritzenhine and Sarah and Ryan Hall, who are, you know, some of them are still competing, but they were that example of kind of breaking through and competing at an international level that was just really inspiring to people who were born a couple of years later. And now, you know, kids who were born in the 90s who are now like coming into their age and they're going to be fast.
Yeah.
So I will say Alan Webb breaking the American high school mile record was my most inspirational performance.
Perfect. Well, excellent. That's the first mention of Alan Webb, I think. So that's a good one. You know, you're the only one.
Really? Yeah. Can I tell another Alan Webb story? Do we have time for another Alan Webb story?
Go. Yeah.
Okay. All right. So Alan Webb came down when I was in college, my senior year. He came down to Furman University where I was running. It was a small Division I school, and no one had ever broken 4 minutes for a mile. Webb had this very up and down career, right? He was very good in high school. He had a rocky college career at the University of Michigan, then came back, went pro, had like a couple bad years of being pro, then got really, really good in 2007, 2008. And he came down on one of those peaks when he was really performing well and came out to my university to try to set a state record, to try to break 4 minutes for the mile for the first time. And that morning of the race, it was gale force winds. I mean, it was so windy that tents we had set up and staked into the ground, the metal was bending. It was just terrible, terrible conditions to run quickly. The track was very exposed. And I think the pacers were off. And so he went through in 1,200 meters at about like 302 or 303.
Yeah.
So, you know, not a good pace, right?
No.
And there was a huge crowd there. I think every runner in South Carolina showed up to watch Webb run, and he called, and it was so loud with the wind and all the crowd cheering that he called out to people on the sidelines, like what his time was, and he couldn't hear. And so no one could tell him the time until like he got through the finish line area. And then someone said like 302, you got to go now. And then he proceeded to drop like a 54 second last lap in these like gale force winds. I've never seen anything like it. It was just the most incredible change of speed and display of strength that I've ever seen. It was just astounding. And so Alan Webb, if you happen to be listening, thank you for being on two instances from me in high school and in college. Anyway, sorry.
No, it was great. Excellent. Well, I better sort of stop taking up your morning. But thanks a lot for chatting to us, Sam. It's been excellent to chat about the US scene, and hopefully we can catch up again soon.
It has been a pleasure. Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate it.
Nice one. Mm. nice interview there with Sam. Some interesting topics to think about when you're thinking about how you're running, how you're training. Speaking of training, we are obviously moved to a weekly podcast now, and we are going to be bringing every fortnight, hopefully we'll still bring you an interview specifically with a athlete or star off the track or road, whatever they are. On the other week, we're looking to do something a bit different. We are going to, it's my final year running. I'm going to be probably hanging up the spikes in this year.
That's a big statement.
Yeah, and I want to run a good marathon. So what we're going to do is we're going to follow my journey to run the Frankfurt Marathon. So we're going to do different bits on speaking to experts about their opinion of what I can do and how I can improve. So we'll talk to coaches, we'll talk to physiologists, psychologists, but with a specific focus on my journey and how I'm going to try and nail this Frankfurt Marathon. So it'll be interesting. It'll probably put loads of pressure on me and I'll completely screw it up.
What time frame we got? When's Frankfurt?
Frankfurt is end of October. So we got we got a bit of time, but yeah, it should be interesting. So if you guys want to hopefully join us on that journey,
we need to know what's your PB for 10K right now.
PB for 10K is 30:15.
And then what about half marathon? We need to know where you're at. So
66. So at the moment I reckon I'm in 30-40 shape for 10K, probably maybe 30. Yeah, I reckon. And then I reckon half marathon shape 67. Maybe, 67 and a half. So I want to get down.
Going back to last week's episode when you say, the athletes always put their target a little higher. So should we bump that down a little bit?
Maybe bump that down, So, I want to get down to 66 and I want to get down to around 30 minutes. And then I want to get a 220 marathon. So if 222 would be great, but 220 would be just a bit lovely. So,
Your best is?
225. But every marathon I've gone into, I've gone through in 69 and absolutely blown. So I think maybe I'll go through in 70, maybe I might be better off. But anyway, we'll talk about this on the next few shows. We're going to be weekly, as we mentioned. So please subscribe, hit that subscribe button. And it's great to have any reviews.
Like I used to say, we need that love.
We need the love. Yeah, we need to get back up them charts. And one lovely thing we had, I should mention, is a lovely direct email to us from Flora. Thanks a lot, Flora. Some lovely feedback about the interviews and how she's working her way through the back catalogue of episodes. That's really nice to hear, Flora. It's lovely to know that we're not just talking to ourselves. So thanks for that. And unfortunately, I haven't checked the reviews on iTunes, but if there's any more, we'll read them out next week. But thanks, guys, for all your support. And you can further support us with the purchase of a lovely T-shirt, which I am getting made as we speak. They are blue, lovely blue, with a white and orange stripe along the front. It sounds a bit odd. It's got our logo. It doesn't sound, it sounds delicious. I've put a lot of thinking into it.
That's a good word. I like that one. Delicious. People want to lick you when they see you wearing it.
That's right. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, yeah. So there'll be I'll let you know the price. It's going to be around 25, 30 quid. Sorry, 25 quid probably. But I will confirm all details with you when they are ready to go. And I'll put some photos up.
Where are you sending them from, Taiwan?
They are English made, mate. English made, English produced. You got to keep English, yeah. So that's good. The caps will be made in China, but the T-shirts are made in England. So cool if you want to buy one of those. We've got women's sizes and men's sizes in the same colour scheme, but we hopefully, if people like it, we'll make different colour schemes, and that'd be nice. So yeah, I'll put photos up when that's up and about, and you can buy them direct from my website, which is letsgetrunning.co.uk. Yeah, that's it. Hope everyone has a good week.
So next week we're going to do the journey of Sean.
Ooh, that to be confirmed. Yeah. I think maybe, we'll start off the first episode of the journey of Sean to Frankfurt. Yeah. Perfect. Well, hope you have a nice couple of weeks, Jermaine. You got anything planned?
Just football. I'm going to do a little seven aside, get into the mix. I've got my little Brazil kit. I just pretend I'm half Brazilian.
Have you bought have you made sure you've taken down your spaghetti? To the seven side pitch of you in your Brazil kit, so you can have a little Neymar hair, put some spaghetti on the front of your head.
Well, I could just grow a mini afro, and then have to put bother some hair cream, make it all soft looking.
Oh god, that's the worst haircut I've ever seen. When a man earns that much money, that is a crime. Okay, anyway, we'll leave it at that.
Oh boy,
but cool.
Oh
boy. Nice to chat, Jermaine. Speak soon.
All right, see you, man. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.